Okay, we are now recording. Welcome all to the, what are we, February 23rd Q&A. If anybody's new with us, welcome. We welcome guests at any time. You can join if you want to, but don't feel you have to. We do have a fair amount of material to go through tonight, so without any further ado, I will kick it over to Alan. Alan, take it away.
As soon as you've muted everybody.
Sorry? Yeah. There we go. And everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves. So feel free to do so if you have a comment or question. And please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to minimum. Over to you, Alan.
Yeah, it's not that we don't want you to talk. It's just that the background noise can be annoying. Okay, thanks, Chris. And good evening, everyone. As Chris mentioned, we have a lot of material tonight. So straight into it. The newsletter came out this week, and there's a great article. The lead article is about avoiding things like scams. And I've had three people I know have been trapped in the past few years by the Microsoft tech scam. And if you read this article and send it to all your friends, it sure tells you how to avoid those kind of things. And I know Micheline put a note on the members forum that a really good article, and so I agree with that. So, talking about Chris, our next item is a follow-up from last week.
Yeah, this Bea actually sent me the link to this, and she actually found the solution to this problem, and I just put together the slides for it. So the problem from last week was that Gmail was offering unwanted autocomplete whenever the person started a new message. And so it would be either old email addresses or email addresses that didn't exist in the contact list and so forth. So I just did a bit of a mock-up here. So, for example, if I typed in CHR, I get Chris Stauer as one of the pop-ups as the autocomplete, and I never added Chris Stauer to my address book. Next. So what it happens is the Gmail automatically saves the email address in your contacts when you send, reply, or forward an email. But you can stop it. So you click on the settings menu, which is the gear in the top right-hand corner, and you choose see all settings, and then you scroll way down, and you get to a section called create contacts for autocomplete, and by default, this is on. So it says, when I send messages to a new person, add them to other contacts so that I can autocomplete to them the next time. And it's not only when you send a message, it's when you receive messages as well. So what you do is you check on the box there for all add contacts myself, and that will stop it from adding any new addresses to your other contacts list. So if you want to remove addresses that were already added so they are not offered as autocomplete addresses in the future, in the Google Apps icon in the toolbar, which is the nine little dots, you choose contacts. And then in the left-hand panel, you go down to other contacts, and those are where all of those other things will get added to. And so you just go through and you can remove any of the ones that you don't want, and they will no longer be added as auto contacts. So you can just check individual ones, or once you check one, you get a toolbar. You can click on the drop down in the left-hand panel, and you can choose all and select them all at once, and then hit the three-dot menu, choose delete, and they'll be gone. So thanks to B for finding that and giving me the pointer so that I could put together the slides.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And moving straight away to smart apps. And we have a couple of apps, two apps this time, Stuart, for you to talk about.
Okay, well, Contour is the first one, eh? This is for the diabetics or people that live with diabetics. The current fashion seems to be for people to have insulin pumps strapped onto them in some fashion, and they self-monitor and self-administrate the blood sugar and the insulin, and that's fine and dandy. But if you're still doing it the old-fashioned prick your finger and test way, the little glucometer isn't particularly intuitive to get the data off of, unless you're using the app on an Android or iOS device. And we've been using this for a couple years now, I guess. And I don't actually go in and manage the data all that often, but every now and then you can. And it's pretty simple. It just pairs up with Bluetooth. If you don't like Bluetooth on all the time, it'll ask you to turn it on when you load the app, and you'll have to remember to turn it off when you're done if you don't like it. If you like it on, well, leave it on. And you can set limits and reminders and what you're supposed to do. And there's a few features that aren't available in Canada, so there's no point talking about them. But if you go into the menu, the hamburger menu on the top left that's visible there, one of the options is, I've forgotten what it is. I think the option is called My Care or something. And in there, you can generate reports of all the data that's been collected, which is really handy if you want to get in and muck about with it or send it to someone else to muck about with. I tried going into the Essentia cloud and creating an account so that I can go in and look at the data they store in the cloud. And I gave up because it wanted too much information. And the data is not for me, actually. The diabetic in this house is our cat. So I'm doing all this for a damned cat. And I just wasn't about to give them my phone number and address and all this other stuff so they can market me with whatever it is they're trying to do. But for all you humans out there that have need for this, I recommend it highly. That's all I have to say on that. The PC Health App. Well, President's Choice is becoming ingrained in many aspects of our lives these days, between groceries and the PC. They have a cell phone company that got taken over by somebody else, and PC Financial and Points, and now they want to get into your health. And this thing, if you just use it for the recommendations and the little reminders on how to improve your life, okay, it's adequate. It basically glosses over the basics we should have, many different things we should be doing better for our health, and will toss you pennies worth of points for anything you accomplish in the little challenges you may choose to try and do. It will try and link you into services and offers, and it's intrusive. I just like it because the little challenges that you can choose to accomplish are basically reminders of how we should be living our lives better. You know, get up and stretch every 5 minutes. I heard that. Sorry, the Peanut Gallery's offering suggestions. It's nothing great, nothing special, but it gives you a few PC optimum points, and it sort of reminds you of what you could be doing better. There are more detailed articles that it will link you to, but I haven't bothered with any of those, so I can't say if they're good or not. And whenever you do get into anything a little detailed in this app, I find it always says you should check with your doctor before doing any of this stuff. So, you know, you should just talk to your doctor if you'd rather not talk to the app. That's all I got to say about this app, but I will mention one other app that I haven't played with yet that is really going to be intrusive. TELUS has a My Health app where you can actually do doctor appointments online now. I'm really looking forward to that. They're trying that because my doctor's 200 kilometers away. So this one might be a review in the future. That's all I've got to say for now.
Okay, thanks very much, Stuart. That's great.
Good luck.
Okay, I have a quick share here. Every week we have a lot of people participate in these Q&A sessions, but there's not that many people post information, ask questions in the chat window. And I kind of wonder whether it's because not everybody knows how to use it, or alternatively, maybe they really don't want to. Another thing is that maybe, as I found out, the font that they use by default is way too small. It turns out we can fix most of those things, unless you don't want to use it, in which case it's that's fine. Anyway, how do you find the chat window? Well, not all of you will have a wonderful, handsome gentleman like this on your screen. But if you look down the bottom of this is for the Zoom client, by the way. I don't use the web browser version. So if you look at the bottom of the Zoom client window, right next to that green square share screen icon, on the left-hand side, you'll find a little icon that says chat. And if you press that little icon, and you'll get a pop-up window. And here you can see that Chris normally kicks off the meeting by putting a message in there. And notice it's from Chris Taylor to everyone. And that's the default. The default is that you send messages to everyone. And generally that's a good idea because you're sharing, you're asking questions and anybody can then answer. So you've got a lot of people who can help you. And other people can see what you're asking and can see the answers. So it's a very useful technology. However, maybe you want to send a message to just one person. And if you notice that on the everyone tag down here, there's a down arrow, which is a drop down menu. And if you click on that drop down menu, you'll get a list of all the people who are participating. So, for example, here I've decided that I want to send a message to Chris, and it's to remind him to mute everyone. I didn't send him that one this week, so he forgot. But clearly this message, it really does only apply to Chris. It's not a general interest. So it's quite useful just to send it as a direct message to Chris only. However, notice that once I've sent that message, so here the message has gone out to Chris, by default, it will retain Chris as the recipient of my next message. And so if you're not careful, you can end up trying to send messages to everyone, but you don't have the right recipient here. So you need to open this up again and set the message to be sent to everyone. That's basically how you send messages.
And Alan, if I can point out as well, if you receive a direct message, the default switches for you to being replying a direct message back to that other person. I've gotten caught a couple of times where I get a direct message sent to me, and then I go to send a message to everyone, but if it was Alan who sent it to me, it ends up going just to Alan. So if you receive a direct message, make sure you switch back to everyone before you send a message. If that's what you want.
Yeah, so the bottom line is for most people, it's best to just leave that set to everyone and send your messages. Okay, so the final thing I had, I think, is if you want to increase the font size for the text of the message, so you can actually read these things and make them useful. And what you want to do is, again, in the Zoom client, go to this this gear icon, which is the settings menu. And then when you're in the settings menu, drill down to accessibility down here, and you'll find this option to set the size of the chat display. And I've changed it to 200%, which for me is a nice, easily readable text messaging system on my screen. So once you've done that, you know how to send messages to everyone. You have a nice big font so you can read and write easily. And if you have any questions, put a message into the chat window, and Chris and I both monitor that throughout the evening. So hopefully somebody will answer you.
I see there's a question. Yeah,
go on.
Yeah, just I noticed a question in the chat right now. Is there an easy way to find the message, especially when there are a lot of other messages? I don't think there's a find function or anything like that in there. I've never seen one. Is anybody aware of a way?
I don't think there is. If anybody knows of a way to do that, put a message in the chat window. There you go.
Maybe one possibility is to copy the whole thing and put it in the a text editor and search from the text editor, because it's easy to copy all the messages.
Well, the easiest way to do you can, but you can actually go at the bottom and click the three dot menu, and then you can save it as if there's a save chat, and it'll save it underneath your documents, Zoom, and then there'll be a folder for the current date, and all of the chat will get saved as a file in there.
Oh, you're correct, Justin. You can actually drag the cursor all the way up and highlight everything, and then do a Control C to copy it. Okay. A while ago, we did a membership survey, and somebody said a lot of what we talk about goes right over their head, and we're asking how we could get around that. And one of the things we came up with was this idea of computer basics, questions, and topics. So the question tonight is there something that you want to know how to do in Windows? And somebody in the club probably knows how to do it, but if we don't know that that's the question that you want to ask, clearly nobody's going to provide the answer. Or then alternatively, is there some kind of basic computer topic that you find very useful and you could share with the group? So if either of those things apply to you, put your topic into the suggestion box. And tonight we have two or three different computer basics topics, and we're going to start off with ending programs. Chris?
Yeah, so occasionally you'll have a program either crashes or just fails to respond or something, and you might find that you can't stop the program. You can't restart it. If you restart it, it thinks it's already running and won't allow an extra instance to run and so forth. And so often the way you cure that is you end up rebooting, which is a pain in the butt to go through. So there is perhaps a faster way, and you can use what's known as Task Manager to terminate any programs that you want on your computer. Well, almost any. Keep in mind that this is not a good way to normally end a program. I would only use this if a program is not responding correctly to trying to end it. So it simply kills the program. So if you have unsaved data, you've changed settings in the program that haven't been saved and so forth, all of those will be lost. So always, if you can, do a normal end on the program. And just a reminder of different ways that you can end programs. So the first one, of course, is just to the top right-hand corner of most windows will have an X that turns red. If you hover over it, you can click the X, and that'll close it. You could press Alt-F4. You can right-click on the program icon in the taskbar and choose the option to close the window or close windows if the program has multiple instances running. You can choose exit or close on the file menu if the program has a file menu. Or you can click the icon in the top left-hand corner of the window, and you should have an option there to close the program. So lots of ways that you can politely close programs. So just reminders on that. So in order to kill it using the Task Manager method, which is the aim of this particular computer basics, is you start off by pressing Control-Shift-Escape, is one way of starting Task Manager. You can also right-click any blank area of the taskbar, so not covered up by a program icon or over the system tray, and you'll get a context menu pop up, and you choose Task Manager. Or you can press Control-Alt-Delete, which will give you a blank screen with just several text options in the middle of it, one of which is Task Manager. You can choose that. Or you can press the Start button, start typing Task Manager, and it will come up in the results list. And when it comes up in the results list, choose Task Manager. So lots of ways that you can start Task Manager. Once you get into Task Manager, the first thing that you want to do is go to a details screen. So it'll come up pretty anemic looking, where it'll have just the visible windows is all that appears. But down at the bottom, there'll be an option for more details. And when you click that, you get a lot more options, which gives you very useful information on the performance of various programs that are running on your computer. So the non-responsive program is most likely going to be in the top section, which is called apps. Those are the visible program windows that are running on your computer. There may be also in the background processes. There's another section down below there, Windows processes. It's very unlikely that it'll be in the Windows processes. They are really tried and true processes. It's rare that they will actually crash. So it's most likely going to be in the app section or in the background processes. Then what you can do is you can click on the header for name, and that will make sure it sorts it alphabetically, and it stops jumping around. If you have it sorted by something like CPU, the order that these things are in will jump around. So by clicking on the name header, you'll sort everything by name, and things will stop moving around, and it also allows you to more easily find the program that you're interested in. So then you right-click on the non-responsive program. You'll get a context menu pop up. One of the options on there will be to end task and choose that, and that'll kill your program for you. So any questions on using Task Manager to end non-responsive programs?
There's a comment from Tom that Process Explorer is also useful to kill or reprioritize programs.
Yeah. Process Explorer is, most people probably find it overkill. It's a very powerful program. It's put up by SysInternals, which Mark Rusinovich, who heads up Azure at Microsoft, wrote and continues to refine. A very, very powerful program. But if all you're looking for is to kill tasks, then probably Task Manager will be enough for you.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So our next item is on drawing math symbols by Linda. She's going to unmute herself.
Thank you. So, yeah, I don't often use the drawing tools, but I was in there for some reason and I had never noticed the math symbol, inked math, on the right-hand side of the drawing menu. So I thought I'd play around with that. So next slide. So what it does is it pops up this empty dialog box for you, and you literally write your math equation or the symbol that you want in the box with your mouse or whatever you use. And so you can see I purposely did a pretty sloppy job on the bottom left there, and pi and sigma, etc. And it pretty much picked them up. I was trying to do rho, and I don't think rho is usually portrayed with a serif, so I think maybe got that a little wrong, but otherwise it looks pretty good and it would probably do. And then I tried another one with the sort of empty cell or capital phi and then e to the power 2 and lambda, and it did a fine job of that. So for me, I think this is really handy because I'm retired, but I do a couple of contracts a year, and I'm not writing pages and pages of mathematical formulas, but the odd time I do have one or two, and it'd be kind of cool not to have to find the right font set, etc. So go to the next slide, please.
Just a comment there, Linda. I think maybe rho is more kind of forward slope than that, and maybe it's looking at that and thinking it's
yeah.
P.
Yeah, so you do have to be careful, and obviously I would have to redraw that because it was too upright. And I have a roller bar mouse, so it's a little tricky to make some of these characters, but you're absolutely right.
you know, you're a hero for trying to use a mouse.
Okay, but then what's kind of cool, so if you put an equation like this, so I just drew it in roughly, and then you can hit the insert button. So down below, I put in quotes, you know, that might have been in the text box in my PowerPoint. It might have just been a sentence in my Word document. And as soon as I hit insert, it adds that I was typing and at the, you know, my cursor's at the end of the word need. I type insert and it puts the equation in for me. So that's basically it. I just thought it was kind of cool and fast, and I didn't have to remember different fonts, names, et cetera.
Great. Thanks, Linda. That's really neat. I didn't know about that facility either. Okay, moving along. Another interesting one from Chris this time again, who also has to unmute himself.
Sorry, I forgot I muted myself. Thanks. Yeah, this is something that drives me nuts as Microsoft goes and decides to change some behaviors that I think are perfectly good and provide you with useful information, and they go and take it away. So the old behavior in Windows, this goes back quite a few versions of Windows, is that program windows, which had more information than what was visible in the box that you see on screen, would display scroll bars. So you could glance at it, you could see the scroll bar and know that there was more stuff somewhere there, and you could use the scroll bars to actually find that information. So Windows 10's default behavior is that, and this was, it started off just like that, and then one of the feature releases they came up with, they changed the default behavior, and they sometimes show a very, very thin vertical scroll bar. And they never mess with the horizontal scroll bars, but the vertical scroll bar would go very, very thin. And sometimes it didn't show the vertical scroll bar at all, unless you move the mouse in the window or use your keyboard, and then the very, very thin vertical scroll bar would pop up. And sometimes it would show a full width vertical scroll bar if you move your mouse over top of the very thin scroll bar. One of the problems is that programs can override default behaviors in this regard. So some of the examples I have here, so this is the window that you see there is actually the settings app. And you can see how there is a very, very thin vertical scroll bar. Very easy to miss the fact that it is even there. So if I was to look at this dialog box and I would say, oh, where's the link for optional updates in Windows Update? Well, it turns out that, and you can see from the very thin vertical scroll bar, there is more information down below and I would have to scroll down to see it. But I may miss the fact that there is even a scroll bar there. So if you hover the mouse over top of that very thin scroll bar, it expands to the full width, and then I can go down, scroll down, and find that extra stuff that is in that dialog box. So another example is the start menu. And in this case, we have no scroll bars. And so, you know, you might be, you know, forgiven for thinking about, well, where are all my programs that I know are on my start menu? And you don't see a scroll bar at all. So if you hover the mouse over in the left-hand section, you happen to get a very thin scroll bar in the left-hand section. It's hard to even see there. And if you hover the mouse in the right-hand section, you get a thin scroll bar in the right section. And if you hover your mouse over the very thin scroll bar again, it will expand out to the full width and allow you to interact with it. Why Microsoft thinks that this was so ugly or whatever that they had to take it away, I have absolutely no idea. The Edge browser, it always shows scroll bars. Well, not quite always, only if there is more information that you can scroll down to, which I think is maybe not so bad, but in a way I'd like to see that for sure there's nothing there because some programs don't exhibit the same behavior. Notepad always shows scroll bars, even if there's no stuff that you can scroll to. So the bottom window, I have nothing in Notepad at all, yet it still shows horizontal and vertical scroll bars. Microsoft Word is a real special case. It doesn't show scroll bars at all. if you move your mouse in the window or if you scroll within the window enough, and there's no magic formula for how much you have to scroll before all of a sudden you see full scroll bars. There's no thin scroll bars anywhere in Microsoft Word. So I think it's a real mess. There's no consistency across the board. Scroll bars, I think, should always appear if there is any material in the window that, or outside of the window, that the window's just too small to display all the information. I think it should show scroll bars. You can improve the situation for some programs, but because some programs can override it, you can't fix it all the time. So any program, and Microsoft is one of the worst offenders for it, will override what I'm going to show next, but most programs will obey it. If you go to Settings, Ease of Access Display, you'll end up seeing down near the bottom, automatically hide scroll bars and windows, and by default now, that is turned on. So you toggle that off, and then you will get more scroll bars, and you can see in the settings dialog box it obeys this, and so immediately I have these scroll bars appear where I can see that there is more information in both the left and the right hand panel. So what are the results? So the settings is pretty good. It will always show scroll bars if the information is not all visible in the size of the window that you've got. The start menu also will always show scroll bars if there's additional information that is not currently being displayed. Microsoft Word, no change. So they don't obey their own settings saying that you want to not hide scroll bars. And so it acts exactly the same. In Edge, there's no change, but the current behavior of it is not that bad. Again, the only thing I don't like about the fact that if there's no additional information to be displayed, you don't get scroll bars. Some programs don't behave the same way, so you might wonder as you're looking at an Edge window and say, oh, is this misbehaving and just not showing me scroll bars anyways? There is additional information below it. So it acts the same. It's not too bad, but I think it could be better. And then Notepad, there's no change at all. Even if there's no information that is not currently visible, you get both the vertical and the horizontal scroll bars appear.
So Tom had suggested that one of the things you can do if you have an appropriate mouse is to scroll with the mouse wheel. At least that gets you to scroll vertically.
Yes, you can, but again, you don't get that visual indicator showing you that, telling you that there's more information. And that bugs me, is because they've taken away a perfectly good visual cue that tells me there's additional information that I can get to either using the scroll mouse or the scroll bars or the arrow keys or some way to get to that additional information. I don't like the fact that they've removed a visual cue that helped me know that there was additional information available.
Okay. Tom, would you like to unmute yourself and just comment on your other item in the chat window here?
Sure.
Web page on the 10 forums, basically to change the Windows scroll bars, and I think it's a registry hack?
Yes, it is. It goes into current user control panel, desktop, window metrics, and you can set the scroll height and width according to an arcane calculation. And I'm not sure what this applies to. I haven't used it because I have a button on my mouse, so or a wheel on my mouse. So, in fact, I have a whole bunch of buttons on my mouse, and I can actually scroll sideways if I set it up for that.
Yeah, most scroll mouses will allow that. If you just tilt the wheel sideways, it will scroll sideways.
And so those are alternatives. I find I'm using the mouse and the wheel much more so than the scroll bars for almost all applications. There's some Pegasus Mail where it's awkward, and there's some other things there may be other applications as well where the scroll wheel doesn't do what you want, but I find that to be the nicest way to scroll or attempt to scroll.
I strongly suspect that the 10 forums that you pointed to will change the size of the full width scroll bar, but it won't affect whether it even appears in the first place. I strongly suspect that programs could just override this and again give the very thin or no scroll bar if they so choose. And I really wish that Microsoft would stop messing with things like that. And I don't think that they should allow any programmer to override what I decide is in settings. So if I put in settings that I don't want scroll bars hidden, no program, either Microsoft or third party, should be able to override that. I've chosen that for a reason, and I want it there.
Chris wants Microsoft to work the way he was right. Yay.
Well, I don't want them taking away perfectly good visual indicators. I've argued with them on a number of occasions about things that they took away. One of the most egregious ones at one point was that they took away the tray icon for Windows Defender. And again, it was an icon that could change color if it detected something, or you know, various things like that. And a perfectly good visual indicator that you might have a problem. And they just took it away. They later on brought it back, but they took it away. And when I bugged it, it was during one of the beta programs. And when I bugged it, they closed my bug report saying that it was acting as designed. And I said, well, you must have really wanted to have it stupid because you took away something perfectly useful. And they didn't respond to that.
Lawrence has a comment. He's curious how other operating systems manage scroll bars, and he's wondering if Mac has similar hidden scroll bar features and Microsoft have just copied it. I've got no idea. I do know that Linux is not the shining light in this thing either. Generally, it's pretty consistent. But one thing I did find was that in LibreOffice, the scroll bars weren't working as I wanted them to. Basically, it lost the up and down one line at a time arrows that you normally have at the top and bottom of the scroll bar. And to get those back, I actually have to use a specific theme for the controls in order to make it work the way I want it to. The good news is it's flexible, so you can do that. Okay, well, maybe somebody will take a look at the chat window and that registry hack that Tom has mentioned and do a follow-up on that maybe next week. Okay, next item is another element of Bob's Privacy Online segment.
Okay, let me just share my screen here. And okay, you seen the full presentation?
Yep.
Full slide? Okay, good. Okay, so this is part 7. Can you remove all your personal info from the internet? As before, I'll be covering just the tip of the point of the iceberg and pointing you towards where you can go for more information. So what personal info is out there, and there's all sorts of sensitive information about you floating around on the web, and we covered this in one of the very early sections of, or segments of this series, but just to review it, this may include but is not limited to your full name, telephone number, education history, physical address, your bank account number and login details, health records, social insurance number, health insurance data, and other personal identification details. There's other things you might want to remove as well. That includes any involvement in political, human rights, or protest activities, any old forum posts or old blogs that might be embarrassing now and or don't reflect who you are right now. There's your old drunken party photos from high school and university and vacations, and anything you don't want your current or prospective employer to see. So can you really remove all of your personal information from the internet? And the short answer to this question is probably no, unless you work for CSIS or the NSA. You can never completely remove yourself from the internet, but there's always, there are ways to minimize your digital footprint, which would lower the chances of your personal data really being out there. However, removing your information from the internet can adversely affect your ability to communicate with potential employees, friends, and a lot of others. Some of the information in this presentation comes from the first article here, and there's some other great info at the next article. And when I finish this presentation, I'll paste all the URLs for tonight into the chat window. So here are some of the ways to at least partially disappear your digital self. The first way is to delete or deactivate your shopping, social media, and web service accounts. You need to think about which networks you have social media profiles on. There's the big ones like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. You might still have old accounts on sites like Tumblr, MySpace, Reddit, and several others. You have to look at what shopping sites you're registered on. Common ones might include Amazon, Costco, Canadian Tire, Loblaws. Others might include places where you've only made one online purchase. To get rid of these accounts, go to your account settings and look for an option to either deactivate, remove, or close the account. Depending on the account, you may find it under privacy or security or something similar. If you're having trouble with a particular online account, you can try searching online for the how to delete followed by the name of the account you wish to delete. You should be able to find some instructions on how to delete that particular account. Facebook in particular, can be a bit difficult. And here's a link to how to permanently delete your free Facebook account without losing all your photos. If for some reason there are any undeletable accounts, go into the account and change the info in the account to something other than your actual personal info. It could be something completely fake or completely random. You know, you can call yourself Joe Blow and you live at 1313 Mockingbird Lane. Second method is remove yourself from the data collection sites. There are several companies out there that collect your information besides Google, Amazon, Facebook, and others. These are called data brokers. And they have names like Spokio, White Pages, and PeopleFinder, as well as plenty of others. They collect data from everything you do online and then sell that data to interested parties, mostly in order to more specifically advertise to you and sell you stuff. Now, to search on all these sites yourself can be a real chore. You know, one problem is to even find them all. And second one is the procedure for opting out of each site is different and sometimes involves sending faxes and filling out actual physical paperwork. You know, think about actual physical paperwork and, you know, what year is this? And this is because these companies want to make it as difficult as possible for you to remove yourself. Because if you do that, they can't make money off you anymore. So an easier way to opt out of all these is to use a service like Delete Me. And this costs US $129 a year. this service will do all this stuff for you, and it'll even check back every few months to make sure your name hasn't been re-added to any of these sites. But again, the caveat, if you remove yourself from these sites, you'll also mostly remove yourself from Google search results, and therefore making it much harder for people to find you. Now, in some cases, if your name is Slobodan Zivojinovic, and you Google your name, you'll probably come up with some results. Now, my name is Bob Walker, and in North America, you know, John Smith is sort of the universal anonymous name. In Britain, Bob Walker is the equivalent of that. And if I try and Google myself, my name, it's like trying to sip from a fire hose. So how much you can find out about yourself and others can find out about yourself can be limited. Third method is to remove your info directly from the websites. One of the first places to check is with your phone company or cell provider to make sure they haven't listed you online somewhere, and then have them remove your name if you are. But sometimes there may be a charge for this. It's like having an unlisted number. If you want an unlisted number, they make you pay extra for it. If you want to remove an old forum post or an old embarrassing blog you wrote way back in the day, and the site won't let you delete it yourself, you may have to contact the webmaster of the site directly. And you can either look at the About Us or the Contact section of the site to find the right person to contact, or go to whois.com and search for the domain name you wish to contact. There you should find information on who exactly to contact. Unfortunately, private website operators are under no obligation to remove your posts. So when you are contacting these sites, be polite, clearly state why you want the post removed, and hopefully they'll actually follow through and remove it. One of the incentives for them to do this is in the European Union, there's fairly extensive privacy rules that the websites have to abide by. And while they don't have to abide by these in Canada, the U.S., a lot of the sites are aware of the fact that if they don't be reasonable about things, they can expect oncoming legislation, because there's quite a movement to have them come up with some good privacy legislation. And in the European Union, there's a lot of movement to have them tighten down even further. The fourth way is to remove personal info from websites. If someone's posted sensitive information of yours, such as a social insurance number or a bank account number, and the website, the webmaster of the site where it is posted won't remove it, you can send what's called a legal removal request to Google to have it removed. So Google will remove it from their search results. And there's a link there to how to go about doing this. Fifth method is to remove outdated search results. Let's say there's a website with information about you on it that you'd like to get rid of. Let's say your former employer's page. Months after you change jobs, you check and there you are still listed on their staff. So you reach out, get them to update the page, and they do. But when you Google your name, the page still shows you up in your search results. Even though there isn't your name isn't anywhere to be found when you click the link. This means the old version of the page is cached on Google servers somewhere. Here's where the removing content from Google tool comes in. Submit the URL to Google in hopes that it'll update its servers. Delete the cached search results so you don't you're no longer associated with the page. Now, there's no guarantee that Google will remove the cached info, and they have their reasons. And if you click on that, the word reasons, if you download the deck, you'll get an explanation. But it's worth a try to exercise as much of your online presence as possible from the internet. And there's URL to get to Google on this. And last but not least, you'll want to take the last step you want to take is to remove your email accounts. An email address is necessary to complete most of the previous steps. So this is why you want to make this step your last if you're trying to delete all your presence on the internet. Depending on the type of email account you have, the number of steps this will take will vary. You'll have to sign into your account and find the option to delete or close the account. And some of these accounts may stay open for a certain amount of time in case you want to come back at some point in time and reactivate them. The reality is you'll need to be patient when going through this process and don't expect to complete it in one day. You'll probably have to accept that there are some things you won't be able to permanently delete from the internet. Some information on the internet is like zombies. You just can't kill it. However, there are data removal services. Besides the previously mentioned DeleteMe, there are other services like Guaranteed Removals, Reputation Management, and Net Reputation. And you can search on data removal services or reputation management for lots more names and info. The services can do either a one-time cleanup. They can provide ongoing monitoring and other services. And in some cases, they'll give you a do-it-yourself guide. But remember, the moment you go back online to email, shop, search, surf, etc., the whole cycle begins again. And any old info still on the internet that you thought was buried may come back to the surface. You'll be back on the privacy and security hamster wheel. And one special case is erasing porn. Many people, especially impressionable teenage girls, have had pornographic images and videos of themselves posted online without their permission by ex-boyfriends or others, and getting rid of these is virtually impossible since the various porn sites, both large and small, actively steal content from each other and endlessly repost it. So it's almost impossible to get rid of it. Even if you go to one site and get it off that site, another site will pick it up. They had a story on this on CTV's W5, and as one young woman that was profiled stated, I'll always be somebody's porn. This is a special case that there's not a lot you can really do about it. The young woman in question spent a lot of money with the various services to delete everything, but the pictures and videos kept popping up elsewhere. Now, for more information, you can search on how to delete personal information from the internet for lots and lots more info. And some of that will include all the URLs I've listed down here. And I'll paste these into the chat window as soon as I finish up the presentation here. So in this session, we've looked at how to remove at least some of your personal information from the internet. The next session will probably be the last, and it's basically as I've gone through these series and researched each particular segment, I've come up with some more interesting information on some of the previous sessions, and that includes virtual private networks, some information on captchas, and even more. This will probably be a fairly short session, but that'll end up finishing off this series. So.
Okay, thanks a lot, Bob. We have some good comments in the chat. Again, this gets posted to the website later on this evening, or you can pick it up before you we finish the session. We have links to some other places about hiding on the internet, erasing your digital footprints. Tom points out that the GDPR, which is a General Data Protection Regulation, if you're a European, an EU citizen, you have right to be forgotten and things like that, doesn't really apply for us, unfortunately. Stu points out remove.org is a website that can help. There's a question from Natalie. If your phone number has already been listed, for example, with Bell or Rogers, wouldn't it remain on third-party sites even if removed by the original phone provider? I'm not sure if others might have comments on that. I would suspect that third-party sites probably don't copy the information. They probably just, you know, go in the background and do a lookup with Bell or Rogers or things like that. It's always possible, I suppose, that they would just copy the information wholesale. But I think it would be more likely that they would actually be doing live lookups to other providers. And so if it gets removed from there, it would disappear as well. But I guess you never really know. And Tom points out you can set up alerts for your name at alerts.google.com. And I think that's it for the comments. And we have no questions in particular. So thanks a lot, Bob.
Yeah, I seem to be having some difficulty pasting the URLs into the chat window here. So if you download the deck, they're all there and even a few that weren't on the list here. So the deck will be posted on the OPCUG website shortly by Alan. So.
Yes, the URLs will be in the deck for sure. Okay, thanks. Well, we have a couple of minutes if anybody has any other questions. Didn't see anything else, as Chris said, in the chat window. And I was watching a video the other day, and you're supposed to wait for 7 seconds. So that's about 7 seconds. All right, let's go into the, I've got a few slides for the wrap-up then, a few announcements for one thing. If you check out the current newsletter, you'll find that the club is going to do a special series of monthly tech talks. And this is over and above regular meetings and the Q&A sessions. They're going to be on the first Monday of each month starting in April and starting at 7:30. They're free for club members, but you do have to register because for non-members, we're going to charge $20, but that's going to include a one-year membership. So once, if anybody's not a member and they join the club, then you have to pay for the first one, but then you'll be a member, so you're eligible for all the rest of them for free. But because we're doing that charge thing, anybody who wants to attend, even members, we're going to have to register. And then we will send you the Zoom link for the session ahead of the actual time. And our first session, I think, is going to be quite interesting. It's going to be a spring cleanup session. So we've got a whole raft of different topics. And Chris and Lawrence and I are going to be sharing the duties on these things. And I think it's going to be really good for a lot of non-members who don't know how to do some of these things. And you'll notice some of them are topics that we've covered at the club already. So for any members, it's likely to be a refresher. But again, if you have friends or relatives or colleagues who don't know how to do some of these things, then this is certainly an opportunity to find out. And I also remind you that in addition, if you don't want to come to the tech talks, if you're not a member and you want to join, we do have this special offer of getting a second year of membership for free when you buy one. So it's a kind of a buy one, get one free kind of membership offer. And I also remind you, if you are a member, you don't need to renew your membership. The board has already decided that because we're not spending very much money on expenses relating to meetings, basically only the web-based stuff, we don't really need the income from everybody's membership. So we're going to give you another year free starting on April 1st. So anybody who's already a member right now, you're going to have a free membership year coming up. So don't send us a check or a PayPal payment. And the final thing is, the next session is next Wednesday, March the 2nd. So if you have computer basics questions or any other questions or anything that you'd like to share with the group, send us a heads up to suggestionbox@opcug.ca and we will save a space for you. We'll try and answer your question. And I think that's it, unless there's anything else in the chat, Chris.
No, Tristan just pointed out that he's working on a little tool that will allow you to easily install, select and install common software on Windows. He gave a link to it, which is on GitHub. And so he welcomes feedback to help make it better. So anybody who wants to try that out, check out the link in the chat. And I think that's it. If anybody had something we didn't pick up on, jump in now or wait till next week.
Hi, Chris. Yep. It's Maureen. I missed part of it. Are those Monday sessions, are they going to be recorded?
We had not actually discussed it.
It's just that I may not be able to catch all of them. It's a timing thing, and I'm really interested in them. So I was just curious to see whether you're going to record them.
I mean, partly we're using it as attracting new members, and that's why we're not making it generally available. I guess the long and short is I don't know.
We could record it, Chris, and just make it available on request.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah.
Well, think about it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Good session. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, everyone, and hopefully we'll see you all next week and get those questions in.
Thanks, folks. See you next week.